From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Back in March, we had Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Anne Applebaum on the show. She has written consistently and eloquently about how the novel coronavirus pandemic is a mirror in which we see the strengths and the weaknesses of a nation reflected back to us. Well, it's been 6 months, and now another moment that's both an historical inflection point and another reflection. The death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the immediate, intense political battle that it has sparked.
An equally divided court, 4-4, can't decide anything. That could make this presidential election drag on weeks and months and well into next year. That is an intolerable situation for the country. We need a full court on election day.
Republicans can't be trusted to keep their word. They're constantly projecting what the Democrats would do as they break every single norm.
To jam this nomination through the Senate is just an exercise in raw political power. And I don't believe the people of this nation will stand for it.
We won, and we have an obligation as the winners to pick who we want.
Just a few of the voices already in the past 48 hours. Well, Anne Applebaum joins us once again today. She's in London. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and a staff writer for The Atlantic, a senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Her latest book is Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism. Anne Applebaum, welcome back to the show.
No, thanks for having me.
So it's just been a couple of days, and that montage we put together was a mere taste of the froth, the powerful, I don't even want to call it a froth, that was a mistake, the powerful argument that is being that's taking place right now in this country. What do you see reflected back to us by virtue of the fact that one person's death has caused such deep disagreement?
I was very struck by the quote you played. I assume it was Ted Cruz, who described the court as being 4-4 evenly divided. What that means is that Ted Cruz sees Supreme Court justices as political actors, that they are pulling for one side or the other, Democrats or Republicans. And if he implies there was some kind of issue with the election or some problem that had to be resolved by the Supreme Court, it would be evenly divided because of the party political biases of the judges. That is an indication of the crisis that the Supreme Court is in and the perceptions of the court and the attitudes to the court have led us to it. The point of the Supreme Court is that it's meant to be a neutral body of scholars who are capable of making judgments about the constitutionality of laws. It is not supposed to be part of the partisan process. Of course, we've been led to this moment over many years for many reasons, much having to do with both parties trying to use the court in political ways. But the crisis has been kind of compounded and accelerated by the Republican Party and its decision, unprecedented decision in 2016, not to even hear, not even to hold hearings for President Obama's nominee to the court. And that automatically pushed us into new territory. And that's where we are now. And that's why there's so much hysteria about this seat, because in effect, there was a stolen seat, and this is one of the byproducts of it. The Republicans also changing their line between 2016 and now about why they are doing this, why it's okay or not okay to nominate somebody in an election year, is also indicative of the fact that we are losing our sense of what is rule of law and what is an even-handed legal, nonpartisan way of solving problems that we should all have kind of deep in our bones, and Congress doesn't respect anymore.
I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but with the in terms of the arguments that the GOP is putting forth now, I will get to that a little bit later in the show. But to your point about what happened in 2016, the prospect of an 8-person court an 8-member court, of course, then didn't really seem to bother Republican leaders here. But Anne, hold on for just a second, because I now want to bring into the conversation Stephen Henderson. He is host of Detroit Today on WDET. He's also a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist as well, who covered the Supreme Court for Knight Ridder for 4 years. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Magna, how are you?
I'm doing well. So first of all, just reflect on what Anne has started us off with about how this moment is, is it but yet the latest reflection of how deeply divided this country is? Or could it also be a moment where the resilience of democratic institutions is being tested?
I think it's both. The idea that the Republican Party has kind of lost touch with the idea of, you know, the equanimity that's supposed to come with governing our institutions, the balance that's supposed to be struck between, you know, your own political interests and your respect for the institutions itself. I mean, the party has moved further and further away from that and toward the exercise of raw political power simply for the purpose of retaining power. And that's exactly what this is. That's what it was in 2016 when they denied President Obama the chance to appoint Merrick Garland to the court. And it's what they're doing now when they say, at least, that they will fill a vacancy created by Justice Ginsburg's death with just weeks to go before a presidential election. One point that I think is really important for people to keep in mind is the minority status that the GOP now has and how it is acting with majoritarian will on that minority status, because that's one of the things that I think most Americans bristle at. I think it's one of the things that people think is the root of unfairness. But here you have a president elected by a minority of voters, a minority of Americans, sending a nomination to a Senate that is also, whose majority is also composed of a minority of Americans because of the way that the Senate works. You can have a majority in the Senate and not represent a majority of Americans. And they're going to make a lifetime appointment to the judicial branch, to the highest part of the judicial branch, on the strength of those two minority pillars that have control. If there ever was a dynamic that would test the strength of our institutions, it's that. The minority provisions, the provisions of our Constitution and law that are set aside to prevent the tyrannical terrorization of minorities mm-hmm. by majoritarian will were not intended to allow minorities to exact that same kind of majoritarian will against the majority. And if it happens, I think there's a real question about what we do in terms of preserving those institutions. Mm. How do we make sure that the Republican go forward in a way that doesn't indulge this kind of abuse?
So Anne, Stephen got to the point that I was actually going to raise about the historical import of this concept of protecting the minority, however you might define it, from the tyranny of the majority. But now Stephen's saying what we have is the opposite. It's the tyranny of the minority. I mean, your response to that?
No, I think he's absolutely right. The tyranny of the minority is every bit as dangerous as the tyranny of the majority, and every bit as likely to lead to loss of faith in democratic institutions and democratic solutions. When people don't believe in the institutions anymore, when they don't believe their votes count fairly, when they begin to seem unfair, this is when people begin looking for undemocratic or direct action or even violence. And I'm saying I'm not speaking to anything specific going on in America right now. I'm just talking more generally. When you look around the world, when you look at why democracies deteriorate, they do so because people have lost faith in the institutions, because they don't believe them anymore, because they don't feel they have, they aren't representative. And as I said a few minutes ago, you know, the other sign of creeping authoritarianism is when neutral institutions become politicized and become tools of the ruling party. And in effect, the Republican Party in the Senate is acting like the ruling party. And when they become tools rather than, of political power, rather than institutions that people perceive as just and acting in the interest of everybody, this is also a way in which people lose faith in them and lose faith in the system.
So you just wrote, though, just yesterday in The Atlantic that if people care about the Supreme Court, the last thing they should be doing right now is talking about it or fixating on it or fixating on this epic clash that's going on. Here we are doing it this hour. I recognize that. But and we've got about a minute before the first break here. Could get us started. Why do you think that stepping back from that is the way to protect the institution?
Because I'm worried that we'll get caught once again in a black and white, apocalyptic culture war where the Republicans can say, you know, we have, you know, it's liberal justices who will destroy your families on the one side versus conservative justices who will preserve your families on the other. People will become caught up in religious issues where people have very black and white views like abortion, and they won't focus on the real issues that they're confronted with every day, the crisis of the pandemic, the economic collapse, the lack of health care. And we know from experience, both in American elections and elections around the world, that when people are polarized, when they're divided into two groups, then they often stop listening to political argument and they simply fall back. This is my identity. This is who I am. This is how I'm going to vote. And I don't want the election to be about that.
Mm. Well, we are talking this hour about yet another test of the strength of American democracy, of the strength of America's democratic institutions. Anne Applebaum and Stephen Henderson are here to help us think through that. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the strength, the resilience, and now perhaps the weakening of America's core democratic institutions and how the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the political response to that is once again testing those institutions. I'm joined today by Stephen Henderson. He's host of Detroit Today on WDET in Detroit. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his many years of journalism, including as 4 years covering the Supreme Court for Knight Ridder. Anne Applebaum also joins us. She's also a Pulitzer Prize winning historian, staff writer for The Atlantic, and author of many books. Her latest is Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism. Her latest piece for The Atlantic is If You Care About the Court, Don't Talk About It. So, Anne, help us with formulating a mental framework on how to think about this moment. So if we are to measure the strength and resilience of America's democratic institutions, how should we be measuring that? What ideas would we use to say, yes, these institutions are strong versus they're not?
Well, I mean, the obvious metric is, are they doing what they're supposed to do? Are people talking about them in the way they're supposed to be talking about them? And do people have the respect for them that they do? And I think obviously at the moment they don't. And this goes across a range of institutions, from the court, which, as we've just heard, is treated as a political football now, openly actually by the president and by leading Republicans. That's been building for a long time, but we seem to have reached a real crisis in that state. The Justice Department, which is also openly acting as a political arm of the Republican Party and of the president, as seeking to shield him from lawsuits and from legal investigations in a way that would also have been considered unprecedented in the past. The Republican Party itself, which when presented with evidence of a president abusing power, using American foreign policy in order to persuade a foreign leader to launch a fake investigation into his opponent, refused to even take seriously the charges and refused to even consider impeachment seriously. All of these are indications that the institutions aren't working the way they're supposed to work and they aren't doing what the Constitution said they should do. And then, you can add to that the protests, violence on many sides that we've seen over the last few months, which is indication that people don't feel their voices are heard in the realm of normal politics, and they feel they have to resort to different means. And I think all of that, those are real. As I say, in any other country, they would be considered flashing warning lights. Mm-hmm. Something is wrong. The system isn't working.
Okay. So the how institutions are supposed to work concept is key here, because supposed to implies like consistency, historical consistency in how these institutions function in a democratic society. So with that in mind, let's just get our scalpels out here and dig a little deeper into what's happening with the court. Because, of course, as everyone remembers, that in 2016, when President Obama nominated Merrick Garland to the high court, Senator Mitch McConnell refused to even have a single hearing regarding Garland's nomination. So here is a bit of tape. This is Senator Lindsey Graham, chair of the Judiciary Committee, speaking in 2016 about what should happen if a vacancy were to occur on the Supreme Court in an election year with a Republican presidential incumbent.
I want you to use my words against me. If there's a Republican president in 2016 and a vacancy occurs in the last year of the first term, you can say Lindsey Graham said, let's let the next president, whoever it might be, make that nomination. And you could use my words against me and you'd be absolutely right.
Senator Graham in 2016 there, he reaffirmed that idea in 2018. But following the death of Justice Ginsburg on Friday, Senator Graham did an about face, calling for President Trump to be able to nominate and the Senate to hear about that nomination before November 3rd. Now, Stephen, one of the reasons why Graham and other Republicans are saying it's different this time, and I know this is nitpicky, but it's important, is that there's a Republican both in the White House and holding the majority in the Senate. And they point to the fact that that was not the case in 2016. And so therefore, in 2016, they wanted to wait to see what direction the American people would go. Take us through that argument. It does resonate with Mitch McConnell and with supporters of the president as well. Does the unity of party between the White House and the Senate majority make a difference this time around?
Well, it's not supposed to, and it hasn't in the past. If you think back to almost any other presidency, there are instances where a Democratic Senate confirmed a justice who was nominated by a Republican president, or vice versa. And in fact, conservatives are the ones who have pushed that ideal the hardest in recent years, saying it this is not a political exercise, and that any qualified nominee should get a hearing and a vote. That doesn't mean that the vote would necessarily go the nominee's way, but that there should be a process that's respected. So this is yet another change, another move of the goalposts on the part of Republicans to say, well, now the standard is influenced by which party has control of the Senate and the White House. And as Anne says, this is, you know, a politicization of the judicial branch that is inconsistent with the framers' vision of the three branches of government. I mean, this was not what was planned, but it's also not the way that we have operated for most of the time that this country has been around. I also want to take a second, though, and lift up the idea that the court itself is remarkably resilient, and I think has operated as close to separated from this political nonsense that comes from the executive and congressional branches and legislative branches in a remarkable way. I mean, the court still reaches most of its conclusions unanimously and without much argument. I mean, they are ruling on law, which is a sort of separate standard that doesn't have a political bent necessarily. Chief Justice John Roberts, I think, has done a really good job of keeping the court out of a good number of controversies. That was one of the goals that he had when he was nominated to be Chief Justice, was that the court shouldn't play such a pivotal role in culture wars and these other things that go on in the political branches. Someone like Justice Ginsburg is a good example of the court and the way that it conducts itself. You know, it's ironic that she will be remembered as such a prolific dissenter on the court, because she said many times that the court's strength and the court's authority comes from its singular voice, that when they speak together, it's the best. It's the best that they can do. The court, for whatever reason, I think, has, up until now, at least, been somewhat inured from all of this interference from the other branches, and I guess the fear has to be that at some point even that wall will be breached, and you'll have more naked political actors on the court. Maybe that's the goal of the GOP, but it's all the more reason to sort of take this moment and pause and think, what are the mechanisms that you employ at this point to stop things from getting worse?
Yeah. Okay. So I do want to talk about that, about how, what are the mechanisms at our disposal as a functioning democracy? Before we do that, though, I want to dig into more about how institutions get weakened, how democratic institutions get weakened. And let me turn to you about this, because so once norms get smashed, doesn't the weakening of the institution get accelerated by how quickly the opposing party embraces whatever new norms arise after how things are supposed to work change? Now, here's why I ask. Because just this weekend, former President Barack Obama wrote a statement about the death of Justice Ginsburg. And I just want to read a section of it. He wrote this on Medium. Barack Obama wrote, quote, 4.5 years ago, when Republicans refused to hold a hearing or an up or down vote on Merrick Garland, they invented the principle that the Senate shouldn't fill an open seat on the Supreme Court before a new president was sworn in. Then Obama goes on to say, a basic principle of the law and of everyday fairness is that we apply rules with consistency and not what's based on what's convenient or advantageous in the moment. And he says, the rule of law, the legitimacy of our courts, fundamental workings of our democracy all depend on that basic principle. And he goes on to argue, and therefore, President Trump should not be able to, or the Senate should not hear President Trump's nomination. Now, I had trouble reading through this because I see this as Barack Obama saying, well, this happened to me in 2016. So the new norm is, nope, we shouldn't be hearing a nomination to the high court now, this time around. Has he not adopted the shattered norm, Anne Applebaum? I'm going to ask Anne, and I'll hear from you on this, Stephen, in a second. But Anne, you first.
So I think what Obama was trying to say was that the implication of rule of law is that the rule you apply in one condition when one political party is in charge applies the same way in the next condition when a different political party is in charge. That's rule of law and not rule by law. In other words, it's treating the same circumstance equally. So I think he was well within his rights to say that. I mean, yes, he's right. I mean, you can tie yourself up in knots, you know, worrying about which is the right norm and so on. But the deeper principle is that whatever the rule is, it serves no matter who the president is. And that has certainly been broken. And the Republicans are certainly intending to break it again. And we've heard many dozens of them now. You can see the contrast between what Lindsey Graham said in 2016 and what he's saying now. You can read it 1,000 times on the internet, every minute. And that is that's the essence of a broken sense of rule of law. So I think he's right to say that.
Stephen, do you think he's right to say that? Because I also see this as, okay, so Anne saying whatever the rule is, the rule of law must apply to whoever the president is. But what if the rule is bad?
Yeah, I mean, one of the best analogies I've heard to explain kind of what's going on with this whole controversy comes from a guy named Richard Primus, who's a constitutional law professor here in Southeast Michigan at the University of Michigan. He said, you know, our republic is kind of like a pickup basketball game, right? You've got two sides who are playing, but there aren't refs, and there's a rule book that we've agreed to, but there isn't really a way to enforce those rules. The norms that we have are what make the game possible and make the game keep going. And what we've seen is that the GOP has decided that they're going to, elbow people in the face when they drive to the basket, or they're going to trip ball handlers and act as though, that's now just part of the game. And then the question becomes, if you're the other team, do you accept those new rules and start to play equally as dirty, I suppose, as the other team? Or do you say, we're going to keep playing the game the way it's meant to be played, and that may mean that we lose. That may mean that the other side gets to claim victory in some incredibly important contests. And so that's not a great position for anyone to be in, right? What is the right answer to that? And I think you are finally seeing, for many years, Democrats have pretty much taken this and allowed the GOP to do whatever it was going to do and said, well, we won't repeat the behavior because that undermines the institution further. I think what you're seeing is a turn in Democratic politics that says, hold on a second. They are ruining the game in a way that will make it impossible to fix if we don't intervene. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to do something to move things back in the other direction. Of course, the danger is once you indulge that change of rules, are you also guilty of undermining the game itself?
Right.
Are you also damaging the ability for it to go on? And I don't know that I know the answer to that, but I know that that is the struggle within the Democratic soul, I guess, at this point, is which direction to go.
And what do you think about that? Because is it not possible that embracing or getting into the fray, as Stephen is saying, in this profoundly asymmetric partisanship that we've been seeing, simply will serve to further weaken or crumble the very democratic institutions that people say they want to protect?
Of course that's possible. I was actually in part of a conversation over the weekend with a group of people who think about democracy, and the expression that was being used by a lot of people was death spiral. So if the Republicans do this and then the Democrats do that, and there's some kind of chatter right now on the internet about when we take over, we're going to expand the court, we're going to add two justices, the possibility that really, really angry Democrats could then make the situation worse in some future administration really can't be excluded. My feeling is that the solution is going to have to be political, and maybe it involves looking again at the Electoral College. Maybe it involves thinking again about how to write some of the things Stephen was talking about, the sense of unfairness that people are beginning to have about both the Senate and the White House. And that's a better way to go than a kind of tit for tat. You do this to the court, we're going to do that to the court, and then everybody undermines it.
Well, we'll talk more about how to strengthen democratic institutions in just a minute. Anne Applebaum joins us today, and so does Stephen Henderson. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about the latest developments in the creation of a vaccine for the novel coronavirus. And we want to hear your questions and how you're thinking about vaccine development right now. So we're going to try something a little bit different. We're going to ask you, or I'm asking you right now, to essentially participate in an On Point Mad Lib. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to leave us a voicemail that we might use in tomorrow's show, and we want you to complete this sentence, okay? So here's the sentence. It goes, when there is a coronavirus vaccine, I will blank. So fill that in. I will what? So let us know. It's 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about how this moment in history, following the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, how American democratic institutions are yet again being tested. And I'm joined today by Stephen Henderson. He's host of Detroit Today on WDET. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who covered the high court for 4 years for Knight Ridder. Anne Applebaum also joins us. She, too, is a Pulitzer Prize winner, a historian, staff writer for The Atlantic, senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and author of many books. Her latest is Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism. And Anne, I wanted to actually just draw some lessons from that book in the context of this conversation, because you write in Twilight of Democracy that given the right conditions, any society can turn against democracy. Indeed, if history is anything to go by, all of our societies eventually will. Do you see that happening here in the United States?
So the reason I wrote that sentence and the reason I wrote the book is I wanted to cure Americans of their complacency, of our complacency, and our conviction that, our democracy is forever, that it was designed perfectly by the founders in the 18th century, that our success, the success that we've enjoyed hitherto can only continue and we can only progress further and become wealthier and more powerful and so on. And I wanted to remind people that even the founders knew when they were thinking about our Constitution that in the past, democracies had succumbed to tyranny, to demagoguery, and they had declined. And in fact, they were reading about the fall of Rome, they were reading about ancient Greece when they were writing the founding documents, and they were thinking about how do we prevent that from happening. So they were aware of it, but I worry that Americans have lost that feeling. We've become overconfident. And that doesn't mean it's too late or that I'm a pessimist or that I think the future is darkness. But I do want people to be aware that this is a real turning point, that this is a very important election, and that civic engagement of all kinds, not just around election times, but at other times, is really important if you want to maintain democracy and you want to maintain the faith that we all have in our political system.
So one of those times is now, right? To the point you're making, that time is now. And so just in the past 2 days, in terms of the explosive nature of the political battle that's taking place regarding the next appointment or nomination to the United States Supreme Court, do you have faith in the resilience of America's democracy right now?
So I have a lot of hope that American voters will understand what's happening and will understand what the stakes are. And I also hope that the Democratic Party will be able to speak to voters on both sides of the political divide in a way that will convince them of the importance of this moment. I mean, what we've had, again, going back to the little clips you read at the very beginning of the program, we've had in the last few days is a lesson kind of driving home the point that the Republican Party, as it's currently composed, no longer believes in the rule of law. It no longer believes that, you know, a decision taken in one political circumstance should be the same in another political circumstance. So they no longer believe that. That's the beginning of the decline of democracy, and I hope that Americans will hear that and will understand how important this election is and how important it is that that party lose.
Stephen, you want to chime in?
Yeah, I mean, I think I guess I would go even a step further and say that in addition to kind of rebuking this devolution of the rule of law and of tradition and standard setting, we really are overdue for a serious re-reckoning in this country of all of these institutions that we're talking about. I mean, I think this is even much bigger than the court or the legislative branch or the executive branch. And it's the way that we have constructed this democracy. And if you think about each of these institutions we're talking about and how badly influenced they were by some of our darkest instincts, I mean, the composition of the Senate, the Electoral College, these are things that have their roots in inequality. And let's be honest, they have their roots in racism and the nation's founding in racism and the drive to protect that racism. I think we have to rethink a lot of these things and come up with fairer ways to make sure that A, people's rights are protected, but B, that there is the kind of respect for majoritarian will that we think of when we think of a democracy. It should not be possible to exploit institutions the way that the GOP is exploiting them as a minority party. I mean, as a party that has not won has only won one popular presidential contest since 1988. Think about that, 32 years, one election they've won, and think of the power they have wielded over that time. It doesn't make sense. And it doesn't make sense, I think, not just at an intellectual level, it doesn't make sense at a practical level in people's lives. I think this calls us to really start thinking about those things and figuring out whether the system we have needs much more fundamental change than we have been considering in order to survive. I think the democracy deserves to survive if it does that. If it doesn't do that, I'm not sure it should survive.
So regarding 1988, you point to that because thereafter, when you say hasn't won, you mean by virtue of the popular vote, just to be clear.
Right. I said they haven't won a popular vote for president except in 2004. Since 1988, the two presidents they've elected since then have both won with a minority of Americans supporting them.
Mm-hmm. So, Stephen, you know that I have more than the utmost respect for you, but I'm going to just push you on something here. When you said you were not sure that a democracy that leads to the outcomes that you just walked us through deserves to survive, my first response was hang on here for a second.
It's a little frightening, I admit
Because certainly we have two things. I'll start with this one. Certainly within the very institutions we have been talking about this hour, we have the keys to which we or the tools to strengthen that very democracy rather than abandon it. Come on, Stephen.
Yes, we do. But those tools are often thwarted by the very provisions that the GOP is exploiting. And when I say deserve, what I mean is that the people of this country deserve a democracy that will serve their interests. This democracy increasingly does not serve the interests of the majority of the people who live in this nation. Thomas Jefferson said that was unacceptable. Thomas Jefferson said that when that's the case, there's a duty to rebel and to reform. And yes, if it's possible within the system, we ought to do it, and we ought to be encouraging people to take far more advantage of the mechanisms that do exist in the system to make sure that that the democracy serves the interests of the most people possible. But if that doesn't happen, I don't think that the rights that we're talking about become any less important to make mm-hmm. sure that they're respected and uplifted. And there are other means. I mean, there are other things that can happen to change. They're not things that I'm wishing for. They're not things that I'm hoping for. But I think they are things that we have to consider the possibility for if we don't make these changes.
So, Anne, let me turn back to you here, and feel free to respond to what Stephen has said, but let me just add something else. We've kept, in the course of this hour, we've used this, we've used the terms majority, minority. But specifically, though, in the American context, regarding the Republican Party, even if President Trump didn't win the majority of the popular vote, it's not as if he only carried 10% or 20% or 30%. This quote-unquote minority we're talking about is almost half of the country who voted in 2016. So Republicans and the GOP very rightly could say we are serving the interests of a huge portion of this country. I mean, that's not insignificant, Anne.
No, I actually agree with you, and it's one of the reasons I've written several times, actually, about the need for the Democrats and leaders on the left to learn how to speak to the other half of the country and to think really hard about how to persuade and bring along and tap into the anxieties of that other half of the country and try and understand what's shaping them. This can be anything from, what we were discussing before, avoiding these kind of identity crisis, black and white apocalyptic forms of politics where what's at stake is, who you are and your identity as a person, and instead getting people to focus on what's really going on wrong in the country, how the Trump administration botched the pandemic, getting away from away from these debates about identity and so on, and moving people back to what politics should be about, which is about how to best run the country for the sake of, for the sake of the health and prosperity of the most people. And also thinking really hard about what's motivating Republicans. Why is it that people vote for Trump? What language can we use to reach them? And tailoring some of their messages to reach those people. And this, by the way, not just for the sake of the presidential election, but also for the sake of all the close Senate races, of which there's now quite a few in theory. Mm.
Now, as we round towards the last few minutes of the show, there's Stephen, there's something that you said that I just want to take a second to reiterate here, because you are very rightly challenging us to think once again. When we're talking about protecting democratic institutions in America, you are also challenging us to recognize that those very institutions are founded, or partially founded at the very least, in fundamental injustices at the founding of the country, namely slavery and racism, right? Like the Senate, the structure of the Senate exists, the structure of the Electoral College exists in part because of the dehumanizing of Black Americans. Mm-hmm. That is a really important point, because I hear what you're saying about let us question with patriotism and loyalty what these institutions are built on. I hear that. And in fact, we should just have a whole series of conversations about that. So come back again. But I wanted to play for both of you one piece of tape from Justice Ginsburg, because, of course, it's her death that has triggered this conversation. Because almost exactly a year ago, on September 19th, 2019, she sat down with philanthropist David Rubenstein at the 92nd Street Y in New York, and he asked Justice Ginsburg then what she considered to be the greatest threat to democracy, and here is how she answered.
A public that doesn't care about preserving the rights we have. You know that great speech on liberty by Judge Learned Hand? And he says that if the fire dies in the hearts of people, there's no constitution and no judge that can restore it. So my faith is in the spirit of liberty.
That's Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in September of 2019. Now, Stephen and Anne, I'm going to both give you just 45 seconds here to that fire in the hearts of Americans that the justice was talking about. Certainly that is still there, don't you think, Stephen?
It is. And think of what we've seen just this summer. 23 million people have participated in the Black Lives Matter protests in some form just in the last 4 or 5 months, making it the largest social movement in the history of the country, larger than suffrage or civil rights or the anti-war movement in Vietnam. I think that's testament to the thirst, not just for change, but for preservation, right? People are in the streets because they want America to fulfill its obligations and its promises to everybody. That is patriotic. Even though it is protest, it is lifting up the American ideal.
And Anne, you get the last 45 seconds today.
What's really important about what Justice Ginsburg said, what's really important about this spirit of liberty, is it's something that can animate all of us, and it's something that can unite us, and that I believe we can still be united around the words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And in that spirit, we can reform our institutions so that they work for the 21st century.
Anne Applebaum is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. Her latest book is Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism. Thank you so much for joining us again, Anne.
Thank you.
And Stephen Henderson, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who covered the court for 4 years for Knight Ridder, now host of Detroit Today on WDET. Stephen, it is always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you very much for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.